Well, good morning to everybody here. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, May 19th, 2022. We have six cases on our calendar today, and this is our second of three oral arguments that we are hearing in person, live. This is A21-1554, Braith et al. Versus Dubin et al. And my apologies if I mispronounce any of those names. Please feel free to correct me when you approach the podium. We will have 15 minutes for oral arguments by appellant initially, then 15 minutes by respondents, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal. My understanding is attorneys for respondents, you will be splitting your time, so there will be 9 minutes Mr. Ormey?
Mr. Nyquist.
Nyquist, okay. And 6 minutes then. Okay, so nine and six split. Okay, and we will make sure that we keep track of the time. When you approach the podium, you can approach either the middle podium, which does have the timer on it, or if you prefer, you can use the podium that is next to you. The advantages with the podium in the middle is that you do have a timer there, so you can see how much time you have. And there's also a button that you can push that's just on the bottom of it to raise or lower it. So we can hear you a little bit better. With that, counsel for appellant, you may approach the podium and begin. State your name for the record, please, and the party that you are representing.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Kimberly Woodgate, and I represent appellant Aaron Kesperick. We are here on appeal of a district court grant of summary judgment in favor of the plaintiffs. The standard of review is de novo. The district court erred when it held that Kesperick's right of first refusal was extinguished upon the transfer of the property from Adolph Colwell to his daughters. We are asking that this court reverse that decision and remand for a grant of summary judgment in favor of Kesperick. It is our position that the contract law is not ambiguous, but this case is a little unusual in that it's more about what isn't in the contract than what is. In order to make sense of this situation, it helps to address it in two parts: what the plain language of the right of first refusal contract does say, and what we do if we find ourselves in a situation that isn't addressed. The express language of the right of first refusal contract does not specifically answer the question, what happens if Mr. Colwell still owns the property when he dies? There are two sentences in the contract located at page A2 of the record that do give specific instructions. One, family members can take ownership of the property without triggering the right of first refusal. And two, if something less than the whole 47 acres is transferred, the right of first refusal is still in effect for the remaining property. The district court, though, relied almost exclusively on the second part, the second sentence there.
Did the district court rely on the second sentence? I think the district court looked at both sentences, but I think the key language here is that the first sentence says such right of first refusal shall not apply for any sale or conveyance to any of the seller's children or other immediate family members. But it says for any sale. Wouldn't that cover a complete sale?
Your Honor, there's two parts to that. Our position is that the district court looked at that and said that that was the end of the story, that it was transferred to a family member, and therefore it's done. However, our reading of it and relevant case law from other jurisdictions says that that it's not there. In this case, when you have the daughters who are taking property of it, they already had a contingent ownership interest in the property, because whether their father used a transfer on death deed or a will or a trust or any means of estate planning, or whether he did absolutely nothing at all, the end result would be the same in that the property would go to the daughters. The case law says that when you'd have a conveyance that transfers ownership or control of a property without a significant change in that ownership or control, then the right of first refusal is not triggered.
But I'm not sure if I'm following. Is this a different argument than you made in your briefs or at the district court? I thought your argument, maybe I'm confused, but I thought your argument was that it was just a partial. It wasn't a partial, so this didn't kick in.
Not exactly, Your Honor. We're saying that the district court used that argument, and we're saying it doesn't apply. And the sellers even acknowledged that in their brief on page 11, saying that the second scenario, the idea of a partial transfer, does not apply here.
Right. It doesn't seem that it applies here. So the second sentence doesn't kick in.
Correct. That's our position.
But the first sentence does seem to apply because you had a full sale or conveyance, which would be any sale or conveyance.
The case law, though, says that it doesn't end there, and the district court
What do you mean when you say case law doesn't end there? I mean, you stated that this right of first refusal, which is a contract, is unambiguous, so we apply the plain language, and which is what the district court did as well, and the plain language says that this right of first refusal shall not apply for any sale or conveyance. You agree that the respondents qualify as children or other immediate family members, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so that's not in dispute. The only issue really here is whether this qualifies as any sale or conveyance then, right?
No, Your Honor. But
that's the language of the contract, right?
Yes. So the way we interpret that and the way case law, as in which we did cite in our brief, the Hartzheim versus Valley Land Creek, that case is very similar to this one, in which the property was transferred from grandparents to grandchildren. We have never argued that we could come in at that stage and take it from the family members. But what we are saying is that it doesn't end there. So the right of first refusal is not triggered at that stage.
Can I just interrupt you? So, Ms. Woodgate, just to be clear, would we, in order to accept your position, have to conclude that a right of first refusal is an encumbrance? I mean, I know you argue that in your brief. Is that sort of a necessary conclusion for us to reach in order to accept your argument?
In further review on it after filing our brief, it seems that it's not required that it be an encumbrance on the land specifically. The way the overarching rule has been decided in these other jurisdictions, Craig versus Texaco, Hartzheim, it seems that what they say is when you have this type of right of first refusal that attaches to a property that is controlled by either a family or a corporation, that it essentially the right of first refusal obligation then runs with the family, not the land. These cases specifically say that when you transfer ownership of the property kind of within this same, under the same parent company or under the same familial line, that the right of first refusal is not triggered by that kind of transfer, but it also is not extinguished at that point.
So it has sort of the effect of being an encumbrance on
yes.
land? That's kind of what
yes.
I'm getting here.
But
okay. So your argument, just so that I can be clear in my mind, is that given that the language in the right of first refusal, what it means is it doesn't apply if you're giving the land, selling the land, or conveying the land to your family. But it also doesn't mean that it just disappears, that if the land is thereafter going to be sold or conveyed, it endures, much like an encumbrance.
Yes, that's correct. That's the language. When then a sale is offered to an outside third party that would significantly change ownership or control of the property, then the right of first refusal would be triggered. It remains in effect.
And your I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Your authority for that is which case?
There's three. Hartzheim versus, I think it's Valley Creek. And then Craik, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, C-R-E-Q-U-E versus Texaco. And in the Craik case, they cite Bellevue versus Oquan, which I believe is French.
Okay, thanks.
Isn't that issue forfeited, the whole encumbrance issue that's being raised? Isn't that being raised for the first time on appeal?
I believe we did raise that, a different nuance of it on appeal, but I would say based on the relevant case holdings that have addressed this specific situation, this court does not need to find whether or not it's an encumbrance to the land specifically.
Okay, so what's your other argument as to why, going back let's go back to the language. Because it seems to me that this is really a dispositive issue, and that's what the district court basically said, is you have a right of first refusal, but here's an exception. If there's any sale or conveyance, why wasn't this any sale or conveyance?
Because, again, Your Honor, that the situation that we're in now was not specifically contracted for. I don't believe that Mr. Colwell thought that he would still own the entire property when he died. So,
well,
looking,
why does that matter? What he intended? Don't we just look at the plain language of the right of first refusal?
But the plain language doesn't specifically address this situation.
It does. Why doesn't this qualify as any sale or conveyance? That's what I'm struggling with, and it seems that exception has two carve-outs: for any sale, which would be a complete sale, which is what occurred here, or a partial sale, and if there's a partial sale, then whatever was not sold, that still you still retain the right of first refusal to the part that was not sold. To the part that was sold, right of first refusal is gone. And the first sentence says, if there's a full sale, right of first refusal is gone, and it's gone completely.
Well, with all, quite frankly, Your Honor, we don't believe that interpretation of that sentence is accurate, because it leads to an absurd result, which is, this, as this court knows, we are trying to avoid. Interpreting the sentence the way the lower court did means that essentially there's an innumerable ways, a number of ways that Mr. Colwell could avoid this contract. There really would only be one possible way then that the right of first refusal would come into effect, and that would be if Mr. Colwell intended to sell the property to a third party while he was still alive. But what the result is that whether you have a transfer on death deed, whether you do nothing at all with it, whether he passed away, as we saw, 18 years later or the next day, any of those results means that the right of first refusal is completely pointless.
Right, but the parties could have put any language they want in there, and the fact that the result ends up being harsh, case law has made it very clear, just because it's a harsh result, that doesn't matter. We look to, as you said, the plain language of the contract.
Well, I think there is a difference between a harsh result and what the court would consider an absurd result.
Why is this absurd?
Because we have to give effect to the point that the parties made this contract to begin with. They freely made it. There was no specific extra significant benefit to Mr. Colwell to make this contract. He received $10 in consideration and kept this contract in effect for 18 years until his death, repeatedly confirming with Mr. Kasparek that he intended to honor it. So if he didn't want to have this contract be in effect, if he didn't want the property to be able to go to Mr. Kasparek if he wanted it, there would be no point to making this contract to begin with.
Well, but if that was his intent and that was the party's intent, then why did they include this language in there?
The reason they included this language was actually specifically for Ms. Fitzgerald's children. It is a large parcel of 47 acres, and it was thought that perhaps the children might want to parcel off 5 or 10 acre sections and live on that. So the reason for this language was so that if they wanted to sell to or give or, you know, some way convey a portion or even all of it to a family member, that Mr. Kasparek's right of first refusal would not be triggered at that point. But
okay,
I don't believe in any way.
And if that was the intent, then why wasn't that language put in there? That's the second sentence, but it's not the first sentence. The first sentence is much broader than that.
Well, the first sentence is that it doesn't trigger if a family member wants the property.
And if there's any sale or conveyance.
Right, and I believe that was for, they didn't know at that time. Obviously, the parties were divorcing. She had children, he had children. They didn't know if one of the children was going to attempt to buy it, or a niece or nephew was going to buy it, or if they were going to give it to them, leave it to them in their will. It wasn't decided at that point what was going to be done with the property, and if any of the children had any interest in it.
So I have a hypothetical, which I know is annoying, but I'm going to ask it anyway, Ms. Woodgate. So if this right of first refusal has the effect of something that endures with the land, you know, so long as the conveyance isn't to the family, what happens to it? What happens to it, you know, a few generations from now when none of these players are still alive? Is it still there?
So it depends on whose generations we're looking at. The contract language does specifically say in two different places that it remains in effect only so long as purchasers, which would be Ms. Nicole Campbell or Mr. Aaron Kasparek, so long as either one of them owns their 5-acre parcel. That's the specific duration, and that's noted in the main paragraph and then also in the last paragraph. There is nothing that in any place in the contract that puts any kind of expiration or duration on the family members of Colwell. So if Mr. Kasparek sells his property, the right of first refusal is done. As long as he owns his property and the Colwells continue to keep the property within their overall family, not changing control, then the right of first refusal remains in effect. And I see my time has finished. With that, Your Honors, we would just ask that the court reverse the lower court's judgment and remand for a grant of summary judgment in favor of Kasparek.
Thank you, Ms. Woodgate. Counsel for respondent, we've got the clock set for 9 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. You may begin.
May it please the court, my name is Dana Nyquist. I'm from Orman Associates. I'm appearing on behalf of Matthew and Sarah Braith. They're the plaintiffs in the underlying district court action. I'm going to be splitting my time with Brian Wisdorf at counsel table. If I don't use up my 9 minutes, I'll defer and give those minutes to Mr. Wisdorf. Appellant makes a number of arguments in his brief, sort of the kitchen sink of our legal argument, but it seems to me that appellant just misses the underlying issue that's at stake in the case. And that is, how in the world did Adolph Colwell's personal contractual obligation under the contract get transferred to the daughters? The contract doesn't say it inures to the benefit and burden of anybody. And I would refer the Court of Appeals, this panel, to the Hempel 2 case and the Stewart.
The unpublished
decision.
Yes. Yeah, we're familiar with that one.
That deals directly with this issue. How does a right of first refusal get transferred to subsequent owners of the property? And the Stewart case, which is an unpublished decision, addresses that as well. There's no language in the contract wherein the right of first refusal is granted that says that this burdens subsequent owners of the property. That's the end of the inquiry, I think. And furthermore, even if you get past and somehow the court considers that the obligation of Adolph Colwell transferred to the daughters, the plain language, as this court has cited, says that when there's a conveyance to a family member, it doesn't apply.
And what doesn't apply?
The right of first refusal or the corresponding obligation. Everybody focuses on the right of appellant. There's a corresponding obligation on Adolph Caldwell, which was live during his lifetime. And the language cited by the court, the first sentence of the two relevant sentences makes it clear that that right and the corresponding obligation is not triggered when the property is conveyed to a family member, and appellant concedes that the Caldwell daughters are family members and it wasn't triggered. But then you have to deal with any second transfer and from the daughters. And how did it get, in appellant's argument, get to the daughters? And that just simply didn't happen. And that's based upon a fundamental principle of real property law and contract law, that a right of first refusal is not an encumbrance on the land. It's not an interest in real estate. It's a contract right. It's a personal contract right that Mr. Kasparek, the appellant, and his wife had the right, and Adolph Caldwell had the obligation. When Adolph Caldwell died, that right went away, unless a contract says otherwise, and it didn't. The analysis in Hempel 2 and Stewart is just spot on. The Hartsheim case, it's not precedential, it's from another jurisdiction. It didn't even deal with how the obligation or the right got transferred. It just simply dealt with whether an inter-family transfer triggered under the particular language of the contract at issue in Hartsheim. It doesn't even address this issue, which is how does the obligation get transferred, or the right for that matter. And Hempel 2 and Stewart makes it clear that the contract controls.
But those are non-binding.
They are non-binding, but I think they're persuasive authority, and this court has applied the same analysis to the fundamental issue in those two cases, and I think this court should do it as well.
So just so that I can be clear, I mean, it sounds like you're arguing these are apples and oranges. They're talking about property law. You're talking about contract law. This thing isn't in, like, the deed to the property. This is a contract between two individuals, and those are the only two individuals involved in that contract.
That's right, Your Honor, that's right, in the sense that there is a property law question. It's raised by this notion that it's an encumbrance and runs with the land. But Hempel 2, Stewart, both held that it is not an encumbrance. It is not an interest in property. It doesn't run with the land. And that assumption is made over and over again by appellant in the argument.
Do we even need to get to that issue?
My argument is that this court can affirm the district court's opinion granting summary judgment in whole on one of two grounds. Either it just simply, the obligation from Adolph Caldwell simply did not transfer because it's not an interest in land, it doesn't run with the land, and the contract doesn't say that it burdens any subsequent owners. Or, as the district court held, the plain language of the contract says, in effect, that it was terminated when Adolph Caldwell transferred or conveyed the whole property to his daughters. And the second sentence, I think, is just explanatory. It just is included to explain what happens if the whole property is not transferred. Well, in that case, the property Adolph Caldwell retains is still subject to the contractual obligation that he honor appellant's right. But it's equally clear that any property transferred to the family member, his daughters, it goes away. It's extinguished. It's terminated.
What about the argument that your interpretation and district court's interpretation would lead to an absurd result?
It's a contract, so the parties can decide what is or is not harsh or absurd. But it's not absurd. I mean, it follows basic rules of contract law and property law. It's consistent with those rules. In Hempel 2, the court directly addressed on both sides whether or not the right of first refusal and the corresponding obligation was transferred to subsequent owners. And they did find the right was transferred, specifically assigned to subsequent owners. But on the obligor's side, the Hempel 2 court said it was not assigned or transferred. It is consistent. The contract is consistent with principles of contract law and property law. And I notice my time is running out, so I will turn respondent's time over to Mr. Wisdorf. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And you will have 6 minutes. Please state your name for the record and party you're representing. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Brian Wisdorf. I'm with WISDORF. I'm with Dougherty, Melendez, Self, Stills, and Bauer, and I represent respondents Lori Dubin, Lene Eide, Leah Caldwell, and Letitia Hostetler. I'm going to address things that were brought up by appellant. I believe respondent's response is sufficient to cover many of the issues raised in the briefs. With regards to the arguments set forth by the respondents Brace, I agree with the arguments that were set forth. A couple of things I wanted to point out was it was brought up, you know, what happens if Adolph Caldwell dies without conveying the property, that the agreement didn't cover that. Well, it's true. If it doesn't cover it, then it doesn't cover it. A contract's a contract, the terms of the terms. There's mention in the brief that, you know, if they wanted to exclude certain conveyances to children that they, you know, or how something was supposed to be handled if Mr. Caldwell would die without conveying it, that it needed to be set forth in the agreement, that it doesn't go on to a successor. That's actually the opposite of what the law requires. If you're going to make this binding upon successors that would acquire the property, you need to set forth that in the agreement. The only successor identified in the agreement was Adolph Caldwell as the undersigned. The TOD, the transfer on death deed, was a conveyance. It is a conveyance that occurs upon the death of the conveyor. In this case, Adolph Caldwell executed a transfer on death deed prior to his death that was recorded prior to his death. Therefore, upon his death, it automatically conveyed the property to my clients as Caldwell family members, which, by the way, were specifically excluded from the application of the right of first refusal language. It was brought up that there wasn't adequate consideration as being a reason for why this would be an absurd result if you were to affirm the district court's decision. That's not the case either. The right of first refusal language, we refer to it as right of first contract in the briefs, right? If you look at the contract covered a couple different things. One, it addressed the issue at hand. Two, it also, Adolf Caldwell was agreeing to allow the appellant to use his property for 10 years for recreational purposes. So there was additional consideration, there was consideration in addition to the right of first refusal that was given to the appellant as part of entering into the contract. For appellant to argue that why would her client enter into such an agreement would be absurd if it didn't apply to the Caldwell children is just misplaced. There was obvious other consideration. I don't think it's an outlier issue. I think it was an agreement that was enforceable against Mr. Adolf Caldwell, and based upon its very language, it was contemplated that any conveyance to his daughters was excluded from the appellant's right to exercise the option if an offer was ever made on the property.
What are we to make of the subsequent facts? Isn't this more than just interpretation of the contract? Because we have actions that were taken by the parties in terms of entering into agreements, acknowledgement of the right of first refusal, language boxes checked, and I realize the appellant hasn't gotten into those, but they did brief those issues. Doesn't that make this more complicated than you're making it seem to be?
What the parties agreed to in the subsequent purchase agreements was based upon that the document existed. Whether or not it was enforceable or not was dependent upon the party involved in each of the agreements. My clients entered into a purchase agreement with Respondent Brace, which said it was subject to the cancellation of a right of first refusal. Respondent Brace didn't believe that it to be an enforceable agreement, hence the underlying litigation commenced. My clients were under the direction of their realtor, entered into a purchase agreement.
Who represented both parties?
Who represented both the appellant as well as my clients in the subsequent purchase agreement with appellant. In that, it was subject to the cancellation of the purchase agreement with Respondent Braith, which never occurred. It made it somewhat complicated than, as you said, than it normally would be. But ultimately, at the end of the day, if the right of first refusal contract is not enforceable against my clients, there's nothing for my clients to base a cancellation of that purchase agreement with Respondent Braith. Therefore, it can't cancel that purchase agreement, and it can't satisfy the contingency with appellant.
And you're over on time.
Yeah, thank
but
you,
we
Your Honor.
Appreciate your arguments.
Thank you.
And counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. It is our argument that the use of a transfer on death deed was irrelevant. The conveyance to the daughters was going to happen one way or the other. That's over and done with. And again, Mr. Kisberg has never argued that he could enforce his right of first refusal at that point. But what we have to look at next is what happens then. The transfer has already been done. And now the question is that right of first refusal still in effect?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I have two questions I'd like you to answer for me, counsel. One is, if you're going to the point that opposing counsel made, if you're going to bind successors, why isn't that language set forth in the document itself? You know, as we look at the language that the presiding judge has read out loud a couple of times, I don't see that language in there, and you're asking us to look at this contract to the plain language, and you've agreed it's unambiguous. That's question one. The second question I have is, in your initial statements, you said that the right of first refusal runs with the family and not the land. And when I look at the language, there it says, if a portion of the property is sold or transferred, the remaining land shall remain subject. So if we go with your argument, doesn't that mean that any land sold under that provision is also subject to that right of first refusal if a family member were ever to sell to someone other than someone in the family who would qualify as seller's children or other immediate family members? And why wouldn't that be an absurd result?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say that that would be the result based on two things that we look at. One, the language, the other language of the contract that specifically provides the duration, which is only listed in two different places, only that the right of first refusal remains in effect so long as either one or both purchasers, Mr. Kasparek or Ms. Campbell, remain in ownership of their five-acre parcel. So that tells us that's the duration of it. The second part of it, the right of first refusal runs with the family. The language of the contract, any express language, does not actually say that. It doesn't say if I own the property when I die or if my son purchases 5 acres and then decides to sell while Mr. Kasparek still owns his property, here's what happens. It doesn't say that. So that's where we go to look at other case law, other jurisdictions who've had these similar situations. And they have multiple times found that that the right of first refusal remains in effect so long as the property has not incurred a significant change in ownership or control.
Why isn't the Hempel and other cases, the non-precedential ones that are applying Hempel 1, which is, did I say Hempel 1 initially? Hempel 2, that applies Hempel 1, which was a Minnesota Supreme Court decision. Why isn't that really more analogous to our situation here?
The Hempel case is different, Your Honor, because it was transferred to an outside third party. When Ms. Ingeman sold the Creek House property, she didn't transfer it to a child or grandchild. She sold it to a completely different third party. And so that changed control. That coupled with the Hempel's failure to act within their time frame or speak up, I guess, when they first knew about the transfer, meant that the obligation had not transferred to the Creek House family. I forget their last name. The West, I believe it was. That's the difference there, that the property had been transferred to a third party. But I would say that the difference here, I believe it was Mr. Wisdorf who said that the language, there wasn't language that said the time for when the right of first refusal would remain with the property. But I would argue that it does. We have two specific spots in here that give us duration, and the only contingency on that is that Mr. Kasparek owned the property. So it doesn't specifically say that that Mr. Colwell himself has to own the property the way it does. And I would argue that if the parties intended that, they would have written similar language to that effect. With that, Your Honors, again, I would just ask that this court reverse the lower court's decision and remand for a grant of summary judgment in favor of Kasparek. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to all counsel for oral arguments. Very well done. We appreciate that. It was good seeing everybody in person for a change. I'm sure hopefully you appreciated that as well. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you all.
Thank you.